Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
You are listening live to In Much Less Detail, the podcast, where we cut through the noise and give you your NFL breakdown in much less detail. Here at you live on a Friday night, October the 14th, 2016. I'm Dre, he's Jay. NFL week number 6 coming up for you in a couple of days. Got started last night with a game only for the degenerate gambler. Once again, if you sat through that, you really have issues or you're a humongous football fan. But Jason got one up on me last week, taking the better team on Thursday night, even though they were on the road. And he paid off for him with Arizona over San Francisco. This time, it does not pay off for him, taking the better team on the road, as I took the Chargers and they wind up knocking off the Broncos. Jason, what, if anything, do we learn from that game?
That San Diego suddenly decided to play some defense. Actually, I should say even better than that, San Diego actually decided to play a whole game. Because, you know, San Diego is basically been a three-quarter team all year, and they went into the fourth quarter, and they were up pretty big and going into the fourth quarter, and I'm thinking, oh, man, I got them right where I want them, you know? Big fourth-quarter lead, so they can watch that evaporate again and then somehow find a way to choke at the end. There was a missed extra point somewhere in there that I was thinking, oh, this will be perfect so that you would get the cheap cover when the Broncos come back and win, you know, 17-16. But, yeah, San Diego played some defense, and that Denver offense was horrible last night. There's something about Thursday nights that just brings out the worst in teams, and it brought out the worst in that Denver offense because it was awful, truly awful. San Diego defense. It's just stunning. Stunning result, but maybe it's just the Thursday night thing that every once in a while you get one of these crazy results.
I wonder if the quality of quarterback and quality of offense on the field for the Broncos made the Chargers defense look better than it actually is, because the Chargers, yeah, they looked like they had a defense last night. And I was as shocked as anybody, and I picked the Chargers. But they had guys running around making plays, like actually making plays. Melvin Ingram looked like a real player. Joey Bosa, the football robot that they drafted, and he should have fucking been on the field long before this, of course, was that stupid holdout slash lockout slash the team is so dumb and cheap they won't give you what you deserve. He should have been out there long ago, but he – had an injury as well as being held out. So he's finally getting on the field and making some plays. Something named Jatavis Brown came up huge at the end of the game with a big sack and then causing the Demaryius Thomas fumble. Yeah, the Chargers actually looked like they came to play and their defense actually showed up. I don't know if that was the Thursday night thing. I don't know if that's Trevor Siemian being even less than what we thought he was. But that did not look like much of an upgrade, having Trevor Siemian back over the Memphis rookie quarterback that started the week before. I don't know if that was any better than the big man. It didn't look much better. Trevor Siemian, I think I may have been a little harsh on Twitter saying that the Broncos were primed for a great comeback if only they had an NFL quarterback. Maybe he's an NFL quarterback. He's not a very good one. And San Diego and Phillip Rivers just kind of keep chugging along and keep doing what they're doing. They almost collapsed all the way at the end, but they somehow held on. It was close, too. They really played that fourth quarter as if they expected to get caught by the Broncos. And you could see the reaction from the coaching staff and the players after the game was over. It was – you would have thought they – survived and moved on in the playoffs to the conference title game or something, the way they were kind of exhaling and holding their heads like, oh my God, I can't believe we made it through. So holding on finally for a victory. I don't think they're as bad as their record at all. I don't think they're all that good, but the luck they've had this year has just been incredibly bad. And they were able to hold on last night. And it really did look like another Thursday night fest or a tired team getting in on the plane and just barely groggily getting off the plane, trying to figure out where they are, what they're doing. The Broncos kind of slept walk through that first half. Defense finally woke up in the second half, but that's enough. That it doesn't take much. If you sleepwalk through one half of football and you look up and you're down, 19-3, by the time you start your comeback, it may not be enough, especially when your quarterback is Trevor Siemian.
Well, let's be fair to Trevor Siemian. I know in the 24/7 world of media, social media, and Twitter, it's everything that's out there, and it's just so hyperbolic with everything. Now, this guy's making his fifth NFL start, and he's coming back from an injury. He's still 4-1 as a starter. He's had some good games, and the Broncos lose one game, and oh, there we go, Trevor Siemian. He's a bum, but this is what it's become. It's just interesting that the Broncos 4-2 with a rookie quarterback, and then they had, especially with what they had last week with Paxton Lynch. I mean, they're doing this with basically just guys at quarterback and a very good defense. I won't say it's as good of a defense as it was last year, because all of a sudden you look up and they're giving up a lot of 18s and 20s and 23, 21. So it's not quite that shutdown defense like it was last year, and it's going to need to be. That almost seems to be like that magic number is 20, because you can't count on that offense to put up 20 every week. But it'll get better for them. I mean, Trevor Siemian has had good games and good moments, but did not have one last night. I don't know if it was the coming back from the injury, being a little rusty, or maybe the Chargers just got sick and tired of losing and decided to show up in a division game and play four quarters of football. It's going to be a lot of factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that probably played into it. All I know is at one point the Chargers had a 3rd and long and they ran the ball and punted, even though they were close to field goal range, because they know how bad Siemian was struggling, and it paid off perfectly because they got the holding penalty in the end zone for a safety, which made it 21-3. You couldn't have really planned it much better than that. So they knew that whatever the reasons may be for Siemian struggling so bad, he was struggling badly, and they knew it, and they took advantage of it and did what they had to do. Now, I don't know if he's going to get much better in the future, but you're right. He has success on his resume so far this season. It wasn't the next coming of John Elway, and he probably wasn't quite as bad as he was last night. So he's probably somewhere in the middle. But boy, he looked bad. He, for the first three quarters of that game, he looked really bad. And the Chargers were the best team on the field, which I would have never guessed would have been the case. I was basically just picking him because any visiting team on a Thursday night, again, I have to have a compelling reason to take them. And Trevor Siemian didn't compel me. But, man, they looked terrible for the first three quarters of that game and still almost made the full comeback to get the win. So it was tight, but the Chargers actually held on to a lead this time.
Yeah, that's the point there, is even as bad as it was for the Broncos and as good as it was going for the Chargers, you still had this undercurrent of a comeback. And it started to see it. And the Broncos had the ball a lot late with opportunities, and they just couldn't finish it out. But, yeah, would you have been stunned if once that got to 21-3 that all of a sudden the Broncos would have scored, tied it up, and won in overtime? I don't think either one of us would have been shocked.
No, I was watching the end of that game, the fourth quarter, kind of clenching my wrists like, oh, gosh, oh, Jesus, oh, gosh. And I'm sure everyone in San Diego was thinking the same thing. Here we go again. But they found a way to hang on. So
they've obviously got this choking streak in them, but they're not going to. You can't lose every game that way. And they
they're trying.
They tried. I mean, they're going to try. They've got the choke masters move working pretty good right now. But even when you try to choke it away, you don't always give it away, you know. But look at how many times they've done it already. I think I saw a stat before the game that said they'd given up 27 points this year in the last 2 minutes of the games this year.
Wow.
27 points in four games. And in those four games, they'd given up 27 points just in the last 2 minutes of the game. And overtime.
That's really bad defense right there. That's really bad.
That's how you fall apart. That's how you collapse.
Yep. So congrats to the Chargers for not collapsing, and yay for me for winning a pick. All right. Our rest of week six picks coming up shortly after I let you know that listening live to our live stream, blogtalkradio.com/inmuchlessdetail. You can hear all the shows we've ever done if you go down to the bottom of the page and check out all our past shows. They're all listed right there for you. You can subscribe on iTunes, Player FM, Blubbery, TuneIn, Mixcloud, and any of those places will send you our show after it's over with, the live show and whatever after show we might do. It'll automatically send it to you after it's finished. Our picks are always up on the blog. You'll have all of our picks for week six, about an hour or so after the live show is over. And you would go to inmuchlessdetail.blogspot.com to see those. I am on Twitter at IMLDDre. Jason is at IMLDJTG. And you can always send us an email. Send that to inmuchlessdetail@gmail.com. And with all of that, it's on to the rest of the NFL week number six in this 2016 season. We're going to start in New England with Tom Brady and the Patriots. Yeah, I think they're back. I think Tom Brady was practicing well enough in his little suspension, and I think he's sharp. I think he came back against the Browns last week pretty sharp. Now he gets the other side of Ohio, and we'll see how he does against them. Brady's first home game since the suspension, as the New England Patriots host the Cincinnati Bengals, who are still missing their tight end Tyler Eifert. I didn't think he would make that much of a difference in the offense, but they're struggling. They don't look quite the same. Probably their run game misses him as well. But in any event, the Bengals are desperate at 2-3. They really need this upset win if they can pull it off. The Patriots at 4-1 and apparently rolling behind Tom Brady. Public likes the Patriots. They're a big 8-point favorite at home against the Bengals. Jason, who you got?
Our big New England lines are starting to come back. I mean, I think people are sort of catching on to what's going on here. So they're building into the number, the whole, you know, Tom Brady is going. They looked at what he did last week, and that he's come back and he's on a mission. That offense with him looks loaded, because that offense is built around his talent set, which is get the ball out quick, everybody in the right spot at the right time. Looking at what we talked about on the after show, looking at what they did with those tight ends. I mean, that's an almost uncoverable situation for most defense. There aren't many defenses that are going to be able to cover, you know, mediocre wide receivers. And those wide receivers, other than, you know, Edelman, and Edelman's more of a finesse guy. He's just in the right spot at the right time and makes the right cut at the right time. Looking for the ball, they don't really have that go-to burner deep threat receiver. They don't really need it, because they're getting so much production out of, you know, now that they have Gronk, and then you saw what you got with Martellus Bennett last week, and who cares about the running game? They're back to running the ball with Tom Brady's short passing game. So LeGarrette Blount will every once in a while have a nice little game, you know, get a couple of goal line carries. Other than that, this is going to be that offense in rhythm, moving the ball. And once again, you've got Brady and Belichick here on a mission. Would be really hard for me to pick against New England, and I'm absolutely not going to do it this week. He gets his first home game, the triumphant return home in front of those fans. I think it mattered who they would play this week. They're due for a steamrolling. So, This feels like it could be ugly. This feels like it could be like a, you know, 40-13 type game. It really feels like a blowout to me. So I'm going to go Patriots squish.
The big Patriots lines are back. You know, what's also back is Bill Belichick's little monkeying and messing with the injury report. If I read it correctly, I believe both tight ends, Gronkowski and Bennett, and the running back, LeGarrette Blount, I believe they're all listed as questionable. They're all going to play, and they're all probably going to have pretty big games. So we got that aspect of the Patriots coming. Everything is coming full circle. Everything is feeling like normal again. The Patriots are big favorites, and the injury list is a joke because Belichick has always treated it that way. Look, the Bengals are not this bad. They're not a great team. We know what I think of them. We know what I think of Marvin Lewis. He's probably past his time there, but I think they're just so afraid of letting him go and getting worse that they're just going to keep him on in perpetuity. But they need this game badly. I'm not going to say they're going to go up there and win, but I am going to take the points because that's a lot of points for a decent team against the Patriots. And the Patriots are, you know, they looked unbelievable. Tom Brady looked unbelievable. That was the Cleveland Browns. Not saying the Bengals are playing great defense so far this year, but they're not playing the Cleveland Browns defense. For the love of God, they're not that bad. So just because they need it, just because they need to get on track, I'm going to take Cincinnati with the points. They still need to get their running game on track. I've seen some movement towards Giovanni Bernard as far as the touches. Jeremy Hill might be seeing himself go to the back burner because he just has not been able to generate anything. So that should help the Bengals if they make that move and make Giovanni Bernard the lead man. He looks like he's ready to go. When he gets the ball, he's running very hard. He looks like he wants to be the man again like he was a few years ago. So he might take that opportunity and run with it for quite a while. And that might be a big key for the Bengals on Sunday if they can – balance their offense and get some running going on their side. But we, of course, think Tom Brady and the Patriots are going to just throw and do what they have to do through the air and be better than Cincinnati in that aerial aspect. But the Bengals are no slouch. They always have Andy Dalton to A.J. Green in their pocket, and they're going to go to that once again. The Patriots have been pretty good. Cornerbacks have come along the last few years, especially Logan Ryan. And so they're going to give him a battle. So I don't think A.J. Green's going to go off for 12 catches for 180 yards. But I think he's going to do enough to keep Cincinnati around and keep them in the game within a touchdown. That's not asking too much, I don't think, for a good veteran team like Cincinnati, who's probably had their pride wounded a little bit by their 2-3 start. And I think they're just going to have – just enough in the tank to stay with the Patriots and cover the number for me.
Oh, there you go. Not really getting cute, just taking the big points. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no shame in taking big points. I just don't think they're big enough. And I've noticed this sort of every other year thing going on with Giovanni Bernard and Jeremy Hill. It's like one guy and then the other guy steps up because he's mad that the other guy is the guy. But the other guy stinks that year. So I don't know what it is with those two. So that means next year Jeremy Hill will be a stud again.
Exactly. Just draft them both in fantasy and try to hope that you get lucky when one gets hot. Our second highlight game of the week takes us to the nation's capital for an NFC East battle between two teams over 500. Three teams in that division are currently over 500. And the Giants right there at 2-3 is not far off. So the NFC East, no moratorium yet. The hype hasn't gotten too crazy. So we'll highlight a game between two foes in that division. We'll talk about the NFC East. The hype machine hasn't spun out of control just yet. But this should be a pretty good one. 3-1 Philadelphia coming off their undefeated start to the season. They got their bye, and maybe that threw their mojo off or their rhythm off, and they go to Detroit and lose a tough one. Now back on the road, going up to Washington to take on the 3-2 Redskins. And we were just hearing all this stuff about what's wrong with the Redskins after the first couple of weeks when they started 0-2. And look at that, they've run off three in a row. So there you go. 3-2 Washington at home, 3-1 Philly on the road. However, the public still thinks the Eagles, with their rookie quarterback, are the better team. Philly gives 2.5 on the road at Washington. And I think that's a little disrespectful, and I'm going to take the Redskins. Even though I'm not taking anything from Philadelphia's start. The 3-0 start was legitimate. The kid Carson Wentz had ice water in his veins, and he played very good football, and they deserved their 3-0 start. And their loss against Detroit last week, as I talked about on the recap show, I watched that entire game, and Philadelphia did not play bad football. They got sort of outpointed at the end barely by the Lions, but they were right there the whole way. It was a very, very even match. I actually expect this to be an even game as well. I think this will be a 3-point game one way or another. I happen to be picking Washington to win. If Philly wins by 3, that will really suck because I lose that by a hook. But hey, I got the Redskins winning. Philly bouncing back from their sort of disappointing outing in Detroit, and Washington sort of catching them late through the air, because that's what they do. That's what Kirk Cousins is apt to do. This might be another one of those you like that games where he gets a late touchdown and gets the victory. I'd feel a little better about it if Jordan Reed could be out there as one of his weapons, but he got concussed again, so I don't expect him to play. Bashaud Breeland should come back for the Redskins in their defensive backfield, however. The Eagles' running attack, I think, is key in this game, because I don't think they're going to take as much advantage of it as they should. Washington is one of the worst teams in football stopping a run, but Carson Wentz has been doing a lot of short throwing and sort of moving the ball that way. They don't want to rely too much on Ryan Matthews running the ball, because he's so injury prone and so they don't want to rely on him too much. It seems like they're trying not to give him too many carries. And their backup backs, Wendell Smallwood, no one's ever heard of, and Darren Sproles, another guy you don't want to give too many carries to because he's so tiny, he might get smashed to pieces. You want him out in open space catching the ball more than anything. So that's the key. I think Philly could really smash the ball down Washington's throat if they had a guy in the backfield they trusted and relied on. So I think they're going to wind up getting most of their points and yardage through the air. And I think Kirk Cousins is getting into more and more of a rhythm with his receivers. And I think there's going to be a late comeback somewhere in there. So I think it's going to be a tight game back and forth, but I think Washington comes out on top in the end, just barely over the Eagles.
Yeah, I concur here. I actually like the Redskins here to win the game too. I'm not so sure about this line. I briefly got an accidental look at some of the lines this week when I was looking at the score on last night's game, because one of the apps that I use to get the score when I'm not able to watch the game shows some of the lines. Now, they're different than what we get, but I saw a few of them. I'm going to just scrub these out of my brain, but these don't look very good to me. Some of these look pretty silly, and I don't get this one. I don't think that Washington deserves to be a home dog here. I don't necessarily think they deserve the cop-out line either, but I think this is more of their 0-2 start coming back to bite them, and then that really impressive 3-0 start for the Eagles. But if you look at the Redskins, Kirk Cousins has gotten better every week. You know, the first two games, he was like 1-2, one touchdown, two picks. Last three games in their wins, he's 6 touchdowns and 2 picks. So he's starting to move the ball through the air. And Washington has given up less points each week defensively all season long. So you see, that's where you see a change in the team. Obviously, this week 5 version of them is not the same as it was with that week 1 team, that game that they lost right off the bat. And actually those two games that they lost right off the bat. So each week they're getting better defensively, and Kirk Cousins has been moving the ball more effectively. Yeah, I don't like the Jordan Reed's not there, but that's a team that's sort of quietly stacked at the wide receiver position. I don't think these guys don't get a lot of love probably because it's Kirk Cousins throwing them the ball. But that's a solid core of wideouts. And that's not a horrible running game. It could be better. I'd like to see a little bit more out of the Redskins running attack before I really jump back on board with them. And Philadelphia last week, despite making some nice comeback effort and with the Lions you know, kind of you got that first little chink in the armor for Carson Wentz. He wasn't perfect. He was good, but now he's going on the road against the division rival. Tough spot. I think the Redskins here have been showing that upward trend all season long. I don't see any reason why they can't jump out to 4-2. And all of a sudden, that division looks a lot more interesting when you have two teams at the top sitting at 4-2, and you'll start looking at, okay, which direction is each one of these teams going? Because you could be looking at the Redskins potentially on a four-game winning streak and the Eagles losing two in a row. And so you'll probably – then we'll start to reach that point of saturation with the NFC East.
Joe Barry, the Washington defensive coordinator, has been getting all sorts of flack because they get the big offseason signing of Josh Norman and doesn't seem to be working out early on. Don't you get the feeling this is the game where he and Josh Norman and Bashaud Breeland get everything figured out and say, okay, we're not going to let this kid out of bumfuck Egypt, North Dakota State, come in here and embarrass us. Everyone else has been embarrassed us. This is the game where we shut it down and establish ourselves and let them know, hey, we're the defending division champions, and you got to come in here and earn a win over us. I think this is where they really make a mark and make a statement.
Well, and not only that, all the talk wasn't about the first week about how, you know, Antonio Brown shredded Josh Norman or didn't shred him because Josh Norman wasn't on him. And they sort of figured
he shredded beside Breeland.
Yeah. I think that the Redskins are starting to figure out that defense and how to effectively move Josh Norman around and roll coverages. And each week, even though they've been playing, you know, weaker offensive opponents, I mean, they just got Mark Trestman fired.
Like, that's right.
We only scored 10 on the Redskins. You're out of here. Even Cleveland scored 16. So, you know, I think they're just starting to figure out, and this always happens. This happens with every team when they make big moves or they bring in a few acquisitions. It takes a little time for things to work out. We're seeing the same thing with the Giants. The Giants looked a little more vulnerable with all these key signings, and now these guys are all starting to learn how to play together, and you're starting to see, you know, Janoris Jenkins and Olivier Vernon, all these guys are making plays, and it's looking a little better. They lost on that Sunday night game to Green Bay, but their defense didn't really equip themselves poorly. So overall, I think we're starting to see the Redskins finding who they are. And the Eagles basically got out of the gate really hot, and maybe they're starting to come back to the pack now.
Yep. All right, on to our third highlight game in the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. Not even close to frozen yet, but we're moving our way towards that type of weather. Always interesting when the star and the pack get together. Dallas and Green Bay, people of a certain age always have to hearken back to the Troy Aikman-Brett Favre battles in the 90s when these two franchises get together, and they bring gaudy records to the table. Dallas 4-1, 2-0 on the road behind the rookie Black Jesus Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott. Going into Green Bay 3-1, 2-0 at home with their man, the Hall of Famer Aaron Rodgers, and they're coming off a bye week. They get a little rested up for this contest. Dallas, and all the love that they've had so far this season, still takes a back seat to the great Aaron Rodgers when it comes to who actually gets the love on the board. Dallas is the 4-point underdog. Dallas +4 at Cheeseland. Jason, what's your pick?
I'm going to actually take the road team Cowboys here to go in and win the game. I haven't seen from Green Bay that tells me that they're back to being that sort of top echelon team. And Dallas, even with that blemish on their record, has been extremely – they've been the technically sound team. This isn't our dumbest team in football, Cowboys. We have awarded them this award several times. They are staying true to what they need to do. They're running the ball. They're protecting the ball. Dak Prescott, nothing extremely glamorous. Although he's thrown for 400 and some yards more than Aaron Rodgers, I know it's one less game, but even at those averages, even if you gave Aaron Rodgers that one extra game, he'd still have thrown for more yards. Aaron Rodgers has been a little sloppier with the football. He's had a few balls picked, which is uncharacteristic. He's also had a lot of balls that could have been picked. That offense doesn't look right. Dallas's defense, quietly, we talked about this in our recap show, Dallas's defense has been playing better. You talked about Claiborne. They've got Carr. Sean Lee isn't hurt yet, as far as we know. So he's out there at least making plays, you know. And the ground game is what I've been highlighting for them. You know, we kind of gave Ezekiel Elliott that sort of unsung hero award there, because he is really earning that draft status, first of all, because, you know, nobody jumps up to take running backs early anymore. But behind that offensive line, you add in a top-tier talent running back, and that takes a lot of pressure off of Dak Prescott. So I think Dallas is going to probably – they're going to move that Green Bay defense around up front quite a bit. They're going to pound them, which is what you need to do when you go on the road. This has all the elements for a team that's built to go into a situation like this and win. So I'm going to take Dallas on the road to win.
To your point of which offense has been more explosive in the air, Dallas or Green Bay, Dallas is actually averaging 8.0 yards per attempt, and Green Bay is at 6.3. And the mere thought of Aaron Rodgers being that much less effective or less explosive than some rookie quarterback, especially without Des Bryant for a lot of these games, and he's not going to play again this week. I'm guessing he's not going to play. I think they listed him as questionable again, but I'm guessing he's not going to play. That's mind-blowing, and it just shows not just how explosive the Cowboys could be, but how struggling the Packers have been. Aaron Rodgers is not back to who he has been before, and I've expressed skepticism that he's ever going to quite get back to that level again, because that was such a lofty level. Just looking at his play, looking at some of the decisions he makes me think, I don't know if he's going to ever be quite what he used to be. However, looking at this game, there's one game that we're going to highlight later on. It's got the matchup of the week, everyone believes, of a great passing offense versus a great pass defense, and that should be the big battle. This battle is just as impactful, the Dallas run offense against the Green Bay run defense, because Dallas, of course, brings the number one running offense in football. Green Bay, much to a lot of people's surprise, if they haven't been paying attention this year, is bringing the number one rush defense in football. And I expected to go deeper into the stats and find a bunch of D linemen getting their noses bloody and stopping a lot of people. It's really not the linemen that's getting it done for the Packers. There's a lot of linebackers and defensive backs coming up and filling holes and making tackles. The leading tackler for the Packers is some linebacker named Jake Ryan. I really can't say I know who he is. And behind him is another linebacker, Blake Martinez. And behind him is defensive backs Micah Hyde and HaHa Clinton Dix. So what they're getting is a real team effort in keeping these rushing statistics down against them. They're bringing everybody to the house, making these plays on the run. So that's the real battle in this one, Dallas running offense versus Green Bay's running defense. And last week I got egg on my face saying that the Dallas run offense would struggle against the Cincinnati run defense, and they blew the Bengals out of the building down in Big D. There's no doubt about that. And in this one, I'm going to, I guess, sort of hedge my bet and say that Dallas still probably runs as a team for about 100 yards. But as far as huge, impactful, I'm not seeing Elliott get like a big 20, 25, 30-yard gasher to sort of put a knife through the heart of the Packers. I don't see him bouncing off of guys and running into the end zone from 15. He might get his yardage. He might accrue a bunch of yardage. But I don't think the Packers are going to let him really score and make a big impact in the end zone that way. And therefore, I think it could be left to the passing games. And even though Dallas has been more explosive, I just feel like this is one of those moments where Aaron Rodgers and the Packers sort of step up and take advantage. There's a big spotlight on this game, even though it's not a primetime game. This is one of those games where the Packers coming off the bye, they probably have a few tricks up their sleeve. I just feel like the Packers are going to actually come through and win this game and cover the 4-point spread. I actually think it's going to be kind of low scoring. It might be a bit of a snot buster type game. And that would be not so good for the Packers if Eddie Lacy can't suit up. He's got bad ankles that kept him out of the second half of last week's game. But I think he's going to be there. I think after taking it easy all week and not practicing that much, I think he's actually going to play. It looks like James Starks has less of a chance to play than Eddie Lacy from what I've been reading. But what I've seen the Packers do, and you've seen it, you've watched Packers games this year, they'll split Randall Cobb out there and put him in the backfield and pitch him the ball a few times. I expect to see some more of that as well. And that's a nice little change of pace when you go from Eddie Lacy grinding on you to Randall Cobb running around with all his speed. I think that's a nice little 1-2 punch, and I think they're going to actually have a pretty decent day. But I've got Aaron Rodgers to come up and look at Maurice Claiborne and Brandon Carr and the Cowboys defensive backfield and go, okay, you think you're good? You think you've been playing well this year? All right, I got a little something for you this week. I think for 1 week, Aaron Rodgers comes back and shows what he's all about, and the Packers get the victory. All right, moving on to our fourth highlight game. Talked about a little bit that it's going to be the Atlanta Falcons, number one pass offense in football, against the Seattle Seahawks pass defense, legendary championship pass defense. They're still number two in the NFL this year in pass defense. So you may not have heard too much about them because I don't want to say the bloom's off the rose for the Seahawks, but there's not nearly as much talk about them as there usually is. The hype is kind of dying down a little, but that's probably for the best. It's probably good for them to sort of lay low instead of being as brash and cocky and talking all the time as they have been. They probably need to sort of step back on that a little bit. But it should be a good one. Up in Seattle, CenturyLink Field, toughest place in football to play, in my opinion. And they will be hosting the 4-1 Atlanta Falcons, 3-0 on the road, and just knocked off the Broncos last week, surprising a whole lot of people as pretty big underdogs, getting the straight-up victory. Seahawks at 3-1, 2-0 at home. As always, their issue so far this year, got to always look at Russell Wilson and his health issues. Will he be 100%? Will he have his mobility back? That's one thing that we won't really know until he actually gets out there and plays, because Seattle is coming off their bye week, and we don't know how much Russell Wilson is going to have to offer as far as his footwork. We know he's a different quarterback when he's got his mobility back, but we'll see. We'll see how much he's got there. He can stand back there and sling it and do some damage just throwing. We've seen him win games like that this year. So one way or the other, the Falcons defense are going to have to get another big effort from Vic Beasley and the guys like they got last week, or else they might be in trouble in Seattle. The public really doesn't think the Falcons are all that, even after their big win at Denver last week, because they are 6.5-point underdogs at the 3-1 Seattle Seahawks. Like I said, Seattle, the toughest place to play. So I understand that. And I'm even going to agree and give the 6.5. I didn't expect the line to be that big. That surprised me very much when I saw that. But I'm still going to go with Seattle and give the 6.5. Questions in this game: does Richard Sherman follow Julio Jones around the field? I kind of doubt it. I wouldn't recommend he does that, because I think of one thing Atlanta has proven is that Matt Ryan will take advantage and just carve up whoever else is out there on the field. If you want to just shut down Julio Jones, he has no problem with that, because he'll just find all these other weapons and utilize them. I think Seattle will be best advised to have a team defense, have a zone attack, keep guys at home where they're comfortable, on whatever side of the field they're comfortable, and just try to stop the Falcons as a team instead of focusing on one guy, Julio Jones. And in past years, you wouldn't say that, because you would say shut down Julio Jones and the Falcons don't have anything else, but that's not the case so far this year. Russ needs his mobility back, Russell Wilson, because Vic Beasley showed that if he's got a matchup issue with his offensive lineman across from him, he's going to take advantage and do some real work. And the Seahawks blockers are not really the guys you want to have against Vic Beasley. They're whatever Tyson Brillo did for the Broncos last week and getting Beasley off. The Seahawks guys might do something similar to that. Russell Lacoon not out there for the Seahawks. But this should be fun. Atlanta, I don't see them going crazy like they've been doing. 10.4 yards per pass attempt is insane this far into the season in week six. That's something you see after like the first two games of the year, not after the first five. Denver cannot trip them up, but I think Seattle will. I think Seattle has been in this type of spot before to have a hot shot offense come in. And I think they really thrive on that type of challenge. I think they were sitting there in their bye week watching what Atlanta did to Denver and sort of licking their lips and going, yeah, okay, they think they're the stuff. They think they're hot shit. They're going to come in and play us. And we're going to show them what's really going on. That's two tough defenses in a row on the road, Denver and Seattle. It's a 1-2 punch. Frankly, if Atlanta pulls this off after beating Denver, you got to make Atlanta one of the favorites in the NFC, because who's going to beat them if they can do that? There's no defense in the NFC that they're going to take on. It's going to resemble Denver or Seattle, or Seattle's in the NFC, of course, but no other defense in the NFC. So if they can pull that off, then you got to look at them as one of the favorites. But I don't think they're going to be able to do it. It's a big spot for them. It's a big matchup. It's big time spotlight on that. And I just think I got the Seahawks with the extra rest off the bye, with the extra preparation, figuring out what Atlanta's doing. I think Seattle's going to come in and make a statement and get a win.
And I got to say, as long as Atlanta keeps not getting any love from the bookies on the road especially, I'm going to have a hard time not taking them. I have to take this offense until some team just steps up and shows me that they can handle it. That offense has been almost unstoppable. This is the last game of that three-game stretch that we basically predicted Atlanta wouldn't even make it through. We said, oh, they'd be lucky to score 40 points in all three of those games combined. And they scored 48 in the first of the three. So, overall, I think they're passing this test with flying colors. Even if they lose this game, they're showing that that offense is seriously legitimate. The main reason I'm going with Atlanta is I still don't trust the Seattle offense. The Seattle offense has been the bigger problem. Atlanta got off a little bit last week on defense. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it that same way against the running quarterback, and this is not Paxton Lynch, but they were at least able to get some pressure last week. Russell Wilson, if that mobility is still limited, he's not going to be able to make the big plays with his feet. That running game for Seattle has been atrocious. So there's not a lot of things sort of clicking for them yet that make me really trust them against this potent offense. Atlanta can move the ball every way that you possibly can move the football. They can run. They have two really good running backs, and they both catch out of the backfield. We were talking about this a little bit when we sort of broke down that Denver game, is this how many weapons they have. Tevin Coleman was a non-factor last year, mostly due to injury, and Devontae Freeman stepped up and filled that void so unexpectedly. I mean, he was like that fantasy waiver wire darling last year for a lot of people. And now that he's the known of that backfield, now you've got Tevin Coleman stepping in, making huge plays, both running and catching the ball. And Atlanta sort of and figuring out from game to game where they're going to make their gains. Oh, okay, you're going to take away Julio Jones? Oh, we don't care. We're going to flare it out of the backfield. We're going to throw it to Mohamed Sanu. We're going to just find guys and let Matt Ryan find ways to pick you apart. And he's only had one Matt Ryan moment so far this year in that Carolina game where he threw the pick six inside his own red zone. Other than that, he's been pretty careful with the football. And if you look at a lot of the games Atlanta's playing, it's easy to be careful with the football when everybody's wide open, or at least the guy who he decides to throw it to is wide open. So until I see a defensive effort from a team, and this could be the team to do it, but, you know, this could be a pick that jumps up and bites me after the game. We go, well, yeah, okay, saw that coming. But until somebody does it, I'm taking Atlanta a big point down the road.
Now, if this isn't the team to do it, I don't know who the hell will. So should be a great game to watch. Now on to the rest of week 6 in the NFL and even more less detail, starting down in the Big Easy, New Orleans. Carolina at 1-4, New Orleans at 1-3. Something's got to give in this one. Cam Newton, from what I'm reading, should be back from his concussions for this game. Jonathan Stewart should be back at running back. They wouldn't miss this for the world. A shot at the New Orleans defense on the turf in the Superdome. I wouldn't be surprised if they got out there in crutches. But again, defensive backfield issues for Carolina. This rookie Bradbury's not going to play. Robert McClain's not going to play. It's just, it might get even uglier than it has been for Carolina. They're still nonetheless a 2.5-point favorite at the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah. Is this the joke line of the week? It possibly could be. I'll go ahead here and take the Saints to win the game. You said it right. You said it exactly. Carolina defensive deficiencies. Did they watch what Atlanta did to those guys? This is Drew Brees, talented wide receivers, Mark Ingram. Yes, it maybe will be a high-scoring game because the Saints' defense is a joke, but I think it's enough at home for the Saints to win.
It might be. I'm going to take Carolina and give the 2.5 anyway, because if Cam can't get right here against these guys, forget it. I think a lot of people think the Panthers are dead in the water anyway. I don't think they think they're dead, and I think they probably look at this game as – this is our get-back game. This is where we get back in the race and prove how good we are. So I got Carolina here. Detroit against Los Angeles. In Detroit, the Lions, coming off of their win over the Eagles last week, find themselves the 3-point home favorites, the cop-out line. L.A. is 3-2. They are +3 at 2-3 Detroit.
I cannot figure out the Rams at all. I'm just going to stick with Jeff Fisher only coaches against his division. So I'm going to take the Lions because they're not in the
AFC. Sounds good to me. Sounds good to me. I'll do it too. That D-lines are going to be a problem again for the Rams. Those same guys that were hurt and let themselves get just destroyed by Shady McCoy. They're not going to play again in this game, I don't believe. So even though Detroit doesn't have any running backs left, they still should have an easy day on the ground and help them helps lead them to an easy day in the air as well. Cleveland at 0-5. Oh, those woebegone Cleveland Browns. I guess Cody Kessler's back. Yay, I guess. I don't know. They are 7.5-point dogs at Marcus Mariota and the 2-3 Tennessee Titans.
I'm going to take the points in Cleveland here. I'm not saying they're going to win, but if they're going to, this has got to be the one, right? I mean, they're going to start running out of chances to win a game here. They have, for 0-5, they haven't been horrible. They've lost winnable games. I will say that. So I'm going to take Cleveland. That offense has actually moved okay when Cody Kessler's been in there. And Tennessee's not a world beater. So I'm going to take Cleveland and the points. Love the hook.
Yeah, I'm with you. It was going to be a very tight pick for me between the sorry-ass Browns or the can't-win-at-home Titans. They just cannot win in that home stadium for some reason. But that hook made a difference for me as well, so I'm going to take the points and take the Brownies as well. I don't know how this game's going to play out exactly, but I'm thinking the same thing that you were. I was thinking coming in, if Cleveland's going to win a game, this probably would be the one. And then I just saw how terrible they've been all year. And that's, yeah. So I probably think Tennessee would win the game straight up, but I'm going to take the points and sort of hedge myself as well. So I'm with you there. The 4-1 Pittsburgh Steelers doing all they can to make me look as stupid as possible for picking them to miss the playoffs this year. 7.5-point favorites on the road at the 1-4 Miami Dolphins.
You're going to hate this pick of mine because I have nothing to base this on. But I'm taking the Dolphins to win.
Oh, for the love of God. Really? I hate it even more after I let you know that not only am I taking the Steelers and giving in to the Steeler Nation and the Steel Curtain and everything else. I also think it's my lock of the week. The Dolphins are horrible. They are horrible.
This could be the dumbest pick of the week, but just tell Pittsburgh's right for the plucking here.
I don't even want to consider if you win this pick how much I'm going to hate you after that. Moving along to Jacksonville and Chicago, 1-3 Jacksonville and 1-4 Chicago. Something's got to give there as well. Jags coming off their London bye are 1-point dogs at the 1-4 Chicago Bears.
Yeah, this is okay. Do I have to pick this one, don't I?
We pick them all.
Gonna take the Bears solely on the fact that for whatever reason, maybe it's a short-term issue, but Brian Hoyer has moved that offense. And maybe there's no pressure on him because that's a dog garbage team. You know, they're crap. They're horrible. Maybe Brian Hoyer thrives when there's no pressure. And there's clearly no pressure. So I'm going to take the Bears to just keep moving the football against the Jags in Chicago. Again, an inexperienced young team, like what they're doing, but not this year.
It's another lightweight defense for Brian Hoyer and company. That's true. But I'm going to take Jacksonville because they're coming off the bye. They're going to be a little fresher. And I think the Bears got a little pixie dust. I think they're playing over their heads right now. I don't think Jordan Howard is this good. I don't think Cameron Meredith is this good. No one knew who the fuck that was before last week. And I certainly don't think Brian Hoyer is this good. So for no other reason than they're due, I'm going to take Jacksonville to find a big play somewhere in there and get a turnover and pick six or something like that, and I'll take Jacksonville to win. Baltimore at three and two, fresh off of firing offensive coordinator Mark Trestman. See what that does for them. Cop-out line, 3-point dogs at the 2-3 New York Giants.
The Giants, as I said, they're slowly starting to show some signs of life. This whole Odell Beckham thing, though, is the big, is the mystifying thing for me. This is driving me nuts. This guy is so talented and just a total basket case. But that defense is starting to gel. I liked what they did against Green Bay, even in a losing effort. Baltimore is a mess offensively. I don't know that firing Trestman makes that offense suddenly move the ball again. So I'm going to take the Giants at home.
He's fine now, though, Odell Beckham. He's hugging kicking nets. He's made up with the kicking net. They had a fight in the net one. I fought the net in the net one. But he made up with him last week. He got his touchdown, his first of the year, and then he went over to the kicker's net and hugged it. And they're all buddy-buddy now. We're all good. Yeah, you're right. He's fucking crazy. There's something seriously wrong with that kid. I'm taking Baltimore, not because I love Marty Mordenweg, who's the new offensive coordinator, but I admit that he's probably more well-rounded and more fit for the job than Mark Trestman was. And just off of that move, I think they'll find a way to be a little more balanced and use their weapons a little better. Rashad Perriman will probably have a big day. Mike Wallace will probably make some moves out of the on the other sideline and get a little more open. I just think Joe Flacco is probably just waiting for somebody to get this offense a little better coordinated and take advantage of his decent play. He's always been steady, and he thinks he's elite. We went through that a few years ago. But I think he's waiting for that. And a big key is if the Giants could get any pressure on Flacco and make him do things he doesn't want to do, would he be able to step up and do anything with this offense? The Giants aren't getting any pressure on anybody. They've got Jason Pierre-Paul and Olivier Vernon, and they've got 4 sacks on the season. 4. That's dead last DFL in the NFL. Dead fucking last. They're getting a lot of rushes up the field, and they're looking really fast and athletic, and it's resulting in no pressure and no sack. They're getting pushed right around the quarterback, and I think that's going to continue, and I got the Ravens to get the win there. San Francisco and Buffalo provides the biggest spread of the week. I would have never predicted that in a million years. 1-4 San Francisco, 9-point underdogs at 3-2 suddenly hot Buffalo.
Well, yeah, and we've got Colin Kaepernick's going to come in and try to run this Chip Kelly offense basically for the first time. I like Buffalo. It's my lock of the week.
Oh,
I'm giving them all.
How much you believe in Cap, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we've talked so much about Colin Kaepernick and his decline in quarterback play over the last few years. So there's no guarantee he's going to be that same guy getting another chance here, especially when you throw in his politics and the way he's become sort of a different personality and a different person. Maybe he sees this as his like big chance to really show that he's worth something on the big stage and worth having a roster spot after everything that's happened. I'm taking Buffalo with you, and I'm giving the 9 points because I don't believe in Colin Kaepernick either, because we've watched him. We saw him play. And also, it's another tough offensive line for the 49ers defense to get pushed around. They look the same. I pointed out a couple of weeks ago that they reminded me of our Alamo game, which is you snap the ball and you try to push the offensive lineman, and they don't go anywhere. They just look at you and go, what are you doing? I don't know what's up with the Niners defense, but they look about the same. They don't get any push. They don't get any penetration, and they're going to get pushed around again. And Buffalo and LeSean McCoy is going to run for another 150 yards or so. And they're going to step on the 49ers, unfortunately for them. Oakland hosts Kansas City in the AFC West battle. This is a curious line to me. As much as I respect Kansas City and Andy Reid, and as much as I understand that Oakland at 4-1 with some of the crazy moves that Jack Del Rio has had, maybe they don't necessarily deserve to be 4-1. For some reason, however, the public really loves Kansas City. The 2-2 Chiefs are 1-point favorites at the 4-1 Raiders.
I'm gonna take the Raiders here, and believe it or not, the Oakland Raiders would have a chance to take a little bit of a hold over the division for a week. You know, they could win this game and go to 5-1 and be all alone in first place. And who'd have thunk it that we could have the 5-1 Oakland Raiders? But I'm going with the offensive talent here, because Kansas City looks like they're kind of stuck in the mud ever since that big comeback against San Diego that I thought would springboard them. They've been fairly mediocre, and we found out that this is just San Diego's move. So things that we thought then, we know now, are not to be the case. And Oakland's finding ways to win, and they've got this whole like magic thing going, and they're at home. I'm going to take Oakland at home.
They will be without Latavius Murray once again in the backfield. I'm going to take Kansas City, even though they probably don't deserve to be a 1-point favorite. And I'm going to kind of be cute here. I think Oakland probably will outgame them. I think this will be one of those games where Oakland has more yards than Kansas City, and the Chiefs find a way to get the win, because I think if any team can be smart and take advantage of some of these crazy Jack Del Rio moves, it's probably going to be Andy Reid and the Chiefs. I think they're going to find a way to expose some of these crazy things that Del Rio is doing. He's asking for some of these moves that Del Rio is making, some of these going forwards on fourth and whatever in situations where he probably shouldn't go for it. It's going to bite him somewhere along the way, and I'm going to go out and say this is one of those games where it's going to bite him, because Andy Reid will find a way to take advantage of that. On Sunday night, it is Indianapolis and Houston in an AFC South game, and there's another cop-out line, 2-3 through Houston.
Yeah, do we have to? I mean, these AFC, I don't even want to talk about the AFC South anymore. Can we just not talk about these games? I'm just taking the Colts because Andrew Luck isn't Brock Osweiler.
That's a good reason. I'm taking Houston because the Colts have allowed 20 sacks to Andrew Luck this year, which is unbelievably bad. And Houston's 3-0 at home. And because the Colts secondary could provide the cushion that Brock Osweiler needs to actually make some progress in the air and actually look like a real quarterback somewhere along the way. And on Monday night, it's the 1-4 New York Jets, and boy, are they desperate. They are 7.5-point underdogs at the 2-3 Arizona Cardinals, who will be getting Carson Palmer back at quarterback.
Yeah, I think Carson Palmer coming back, Arizona at home, I think it's a little too much Arizona. This team is way too good for the record that they have. And they sort of saved it for themselves a little bit, getting that win last week, even without Carson Palmer. I think that Carson Palmer comes back, he gets right, he gets his Santa Claus tendencies out of the way, and they win this game and cover.
Carson Palmer would not miss this secondary for the world. And yet I'm still going to take the Jets because they're very, very, very desperate. And I just got a feeling they're going to come out and be professional here. They need a professional win, and they haven't done that very much this year. And against Carson Palmer, just making it back from injury, I think this is a good spot for them to do that. More on our after show when we come back. All right, now we're into our after show, you were saying.
I was going to say, even with turnover Bernie Sanders?
even with turnovers, I think they're smart enough to not leave it in his hands too much anymore. I don't think they're going to let him they're going to rely on Matt Forte and the running game to really carry the day in this game, I believe. That's how I see that shaking out.
Yeah, it's the Monday night game. Yeah, we could have gotten a better Monday night game than that, but who knew? We knew that these teams were going to start off so sluggish, and ever since that sort of thrashing that they gave Buffalo, it feels like a long time ago, the Jets have been really bad ever since.
Yeah.
You know, and that win against Cincinnati where, you know, actually they lost to Cincinnati. That was the Darrell Revis game. So, you know, if somebody's going to try to throw the ball up top and take advantage of Darrell Revis out there, it might be Carson Palmer. We could see a lot of John Brown going deep in this game. We haven't seen their deep game at all. If they're going to run out the deep game, this could be it.
Yeah, it should be it. This is the perfect time for them to break that out, but I'm not going to trust Carson Palmer to do that accurately in his first game back from being concussed because they haven't been on that level. They haven't been on that same page all year, so I don't think they're going to get necessarily on the same page in this one. They could. They very well could, and they should try to. But I think I got the Jets because they should be so desperate at 1-4. They're playing, I think, better than their record indicates, but it's been so terrible that secondary and the big plays they've been giving up has really been awful. And I think once they find a way to shore that up, then they'll get back to being a better all-around team. They shore that up. They make sure that Ryan Fitzpatrick doesn't distribute the ball freely to the other defenders like candy to kids on Halloween. And once they get all that figured out, they should get back to being a much better team.
Yeah, and we need to sort of get into the second edition here of my sort of unheralded players that aren't getting enough love from us on this show.
David Johnson.
David Johnson.
I knew that was coming. Yeah, yeah. He's a bitch.
Monster this year. And, you know, not getting the love he deserves, maybe because, one, he plays in the desert. Two, the Cardinals haven't been very good so far, you know. So there's a couple of reasons. But David Johnson has been an absolute beast all year, and each week he's getting better. I don't – maybe Carson Palmer doesn't have to have an amazing game because just that guy back there, that was enough even with Drew Stanton. They leaned on David Johnson, and he showed that he was up to the task. I think they're on to something with this kid, and I think we're going to start to see a lot more of him. But, you know, Carson Palmer's – he's been retired for 10 years, you know. He's going to end, you know. We watched his retirement live on TV, you know, when he got rolled up on. He just hasn't gotten the memo yet. So, you know, he's not getting any younger. And they are truly onto something with this David Johnson because he's another one of these. He can run. He's big. He's fast. He can catch. Extremely versatile running back. And that is a weapon. That's a major weapon for them. I remember that game when he broke out last year. I think it was against the Bears, where he just went off, like returning kicks, returning punts, out of the backfield. This guy was getting limited touches last year, but every time he touched the ball, you knew it was like, okay, this could be electric. And now that he's there in the full-time gig, it stinks that they're 2-3, and this guy's not getting the love that he deserves. But, yeah, I mean, we want to highlight players that haven't gotten our respect yet. You know, I gave it to Ezekiel Elliott, and now I'm definitely going to need to give it to David Johnson.
No, I love him too. I actually have them getting somewhat neutralized in this game because the Jets are giving up 3 yards per carry. They're good. They're angry. They're embarrassed for what the pass defense has done. And I just think they're going to get it together in this game. They need to get it together in this game. So I'm really, I don't want it to sound like I'm all in on the Jets, but I think this is a game for them to really reestablish what they should be. And the Cardinals, again, it's Carson Palmer coming off the injury is what has me kind of worried. Him concussed, he could turn back into interception Santa. We got interception Bernie versus interception Santa, the meeting of the minds here. And it could very well come down to turnovers deciding the game. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, so what would you put over under at on this game for interceptions thrown by both starting quarterbacks?
5.5.
That's my number. I was going to say 5.5. I was going to say that would be the line in Vegas.
That would be my line, yeah.
But not for these guys, because these guys are capable of putting a 10 between.
The Christmas decorations are going up everywhere, and Interception Santa might be ripe for about 3 or 4 of those.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and then all you need from Ryan Fitzpatrick is 1 or 2?
Right.
It could happen.
Or vice versa. It can easily happen either way.
Right. I also have to look at the team that's more likely to turn the other over. I think that's Arizona here. I think they could be more likely to make some more critical plays on defense. But we'll see. We disagree quite a bit this week. It's going to be an interesting week.
Let's see. Counting Thursday, that would make 4 the rest of this week. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh, my goodness.
Just trying to make it all back right now.
Yeah. Big spin of the wheel. I got to pray for 5-5 if that's the case. Whew. So yeah, it should be a hell of a week.
If I go 2-8 against you, it could be over.
Yeah, that might be curtains right there. That's true.
You can just the rest of the shows for this season just be like, okay, you won.
All right, so we both have reasons to have a limited after show on this late evening. So did you want to make it all about baseball?
Well, we didn't really get a chance to fully digest that comeback win of the Cubs the other night. So, I guess, wasn't making for compelling radio. But I have to say, because even after we ended the show, that was not completed, that whole comeback hadn't come all the way to fruition. And just
no, I let you go before they completed it.
And it was the weirdest feeling, because I'm jumping up off my couch when David Ross hits the home run to tie the game, and I'm excited at every other moment. But that whole ninth inning, and even through the after show, even through the ninth, bottom of the ninth, with Chapman striking the three, just blowing the three guys away. I mean, those guys had zero chance against Chapman. He was not – he was hitting his – when you're throwing 102 and you're hitting your spots.
On the black. 102 on the black, really?
When you're nibbling at 101, it's over. If you can hit that spot. So he had – there was nothing cheap that he was doing and just blew those three guys. But I didn't cheer. I seriously did not cheer through any of it. I sat here on my couch watching the game and just stunned disbelief was the only feeling that I had. I was like, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I mean, it was just like, wait a minute. This is supposed to be happening to the Cubs. We're not supposed to do this to them. They took our move. This is how we lose. Like winning game one with the ball dropping into the basket, into the teeth of the wind. That's not how that ball gets caught. And then to win the game in a comeback style like that. And it was legit. I mean, there weren't any bad calls. There were no bad bounces, single, walk, double. I mean, and then the whole Bruce Bochy making that those pitches. I commented early in that inning with you on the air about what is he doing? This is dumb. and he had to go through that many pitches, and they didn't get anybody out.
And, now, is Worth for Prosperity going back and reliving play by play that incredible top of the ninth inning? Even if you are aware of it and went back and caught up, a lot of people were sleeping when it happened. So, top of the ninth, Cubs Giants last Tuesday, a couple nights ago. The Cubs are trailing, was it 5-2? And Bruce Bochy decides to start that inning by having some kid come in named Derek Law to pitch to who might be the MVP of the league, Chris Bryant. I don't know who the fuck Derek Law is. He gave up a single to Chris Bryant. That was the end of Derek Law, because immediately Bochy pulls him for lefty Javier Lopez to pitch to Anthony Rizzo. Javier Lopez walks Anthony Rizzo. Bruce Bochy says that's enough of Javier Lopez. He goes to the man who has been his closer now for maybe the last week and a half, 2 weeks, Sergio Romo. So you go, okay, well, so this is the third pitcher of the inning. There's two on, nobody out. He's going to leave Romo in there to get the rest of these guys, and whatever happens, happens, you would think. Switch hitter Ben Zobrist comes up, batting from the left side. He doubles down the right field line to score Bryant and put Rizzo at third. That's enough of Sergio Romo. They announce a left-handed hitter, Chris Coughlin, as a pinch hitter for Addison Russell. That move in itself is ballsy by the manager, Joe Maddon, because Addison Russell is no slouch. And yet he sends Chris Coughlin up as a pinch hitter. And Bochy overreacts to that by yanking Sergio Romo.
95 RBIs for Addison Russell. 95. And he lifted him.
Yeah. And Bochy just completely shits his pants and has to find another left-hander to pitch to Chris Coughlin, except Joe Maddon says, all right, I won't bet Chris Coughlin after all. I'll pull him back and send up this guy, Wilson Contreras, who's pretty good, the rookie catcher. Contreras singles up the middle to score Anthony Rizzo, and we're tied at five to score Rizzo and Zobrist, actually. Two-run single. They didn't make another pitching change. They actually left the lefty Will Smith in to pitch to Jason Hayward, who tried to lay down a bunt to get Contreras to second. Bunt was a little too hard. They threw Contreras out at second for the force out. But on the transfer to throw to first by the shortstop, Drandon Crawford was wild. And Hayward reaches and then also takes second because the throw almost went into the stands. That's enough of Will Smith. Now's right-hander Hunter Strickland is on. To face Javier Baez, who singles up the middle and scores Jason Hayward to put the Cubs ahead 6-5. I've never seen that many pitching changes in one inning. That was, what, five different pitchers? Because that was a change to start the ninth to put in that kid Law. He had replaced Matt Moore, who pitched eight innings and was excellent. So that was a change, and then it was four other changes after that. So I've never seen anything quite like that. Far be it from me to second-guess Bruce Bochy, who's got three more World Series championships than I'll ever have. But seriously, what the fuck was that? What are you doing? Stick with some. Pick a guy and stick with it. It reminded me of myself flipping channels. My wife would just sit there and, will you pick a channel and stick with it? It was incredible. You got to, somewhere along the way, you got to find someone you trust enough to just say, I'm going to stay with this guy and let the chips fall where they may. I don't know which one of those moves you want to pick as the craziest or the dumbest. I'm going to go with reacting to Chris Coughlin coming to the plate by saying, oh my God, it's the great Chris Coughlin. I have to find a left-hander to replace my righty and go after Chris Coughlin, because God forbid my righty faces Chris Coughlin. Why do you have to find a lefty to face Chris Coughlin? And then Maddon pulls him back and sends up Wilson Contreras, who's a much more dangerous hitter than Chris Coughlin. So he fucked himself right there. I'm thinking Bochy stood there after Coughlin got pulled back and Wilson Contreras got sent up. And he probably stood there before Contreras got to the plate going, oh, fuck, what have I done? What? Oh, what have I done? No. That would be my guess.
Yeah. I almost kind of wonder if Bochy got so wrapped up in playing matchups that Maddon almost kind of like deked him, you know? That, oh, okay, I'll, because it's like almost like Bochy get to be predictable and Maddon sort of goes, oh, okay, so I want this particular matchup, or he's playing to a matchup, and he pulled Addison Russell for the lefty to face the righty. You almost had to guess that Bochy was going to go, oh, wait a minute, I got to play the matchups here. You know, we don't want Chris Coughlin with his 188 average. And then to have Contreras come up, that just everything went perfect, you know, and basically it was the third time in history that that's happened in that situation in the playoffs, third time ever that's been that big of a deficit in that type of a situation. And it was something like 840 tries. So, you know, somebody said that the Cubs, you know, so it only happened in like 840 tries. And somebody's like, oh, you know, the Cubs, you could have played that 100 times and the Cubs would have never, no, you could have played it 420 times. They never would have come back. I mean, because that is statistically what the numbers show. Baseball's been around long enough that if it's 2 out of 840, that's a low number. That's a very low chance. And to pull off something like that and to see that the Cubs, you know, they're sitting in the bolt, the dugout all dejected, and that they've got that look like, oh, Christ, you know, we got to go back to Chicago. We got to face Cueto. They're going to have Bumgarner coming out of the pen. Even if we, you know, even if we have Lester out there, it's going to be another fight. It's going to be a struggle. Are we going to lose this thing? You know, are we not the team of destiny? And then that whole thing happened, and then all of a sudden that look that all the Cubs had in the dugout was the look that all the fans had. because they're just sitting there like, what just happened? Does it look, I had that same look, not the sad look, but my look, I'm just sitting on my couch like, we won? What? I'm prepared. My mind, my soul, everything is prepared for game five, and they're going to go back to Chicago. The Cubs are going to try really hard, and they're going to lose because they're the Cubs. And wait a minute, wait, we're in the LCS. I still can't almost believe that it happened. But we actually did the thing to another. It always happens to us.
That was not an MLB 16 The Show simulation. That actually happened. You actually sat there and watched it. And part of it was captured at the end of our after show for forever and ever.
You know, yeah, and then you're listening to us on the after show, and all of a sudden I see Zobrist get the hit to get him the second and third in the driving run. I'm like, oh, okay, all right, there you go. You know, and I'm breaking it down, you know, I want to walk right here. I called the Anthony Rizzo, draws the walk.
Right.
And I was going on my tangent about the home run being the rally killer there, where I, you know, you want to keep the conga line going, keep the press. And that's exactly what they did. They did this whole comeback. Nobody hit the 3-run homer. They just kept the bases moving. And you know, even Hayward bumps into what looked like it could have been a double play. Although when you look at the replay, I'm not sure he's even out on a good throw. But either way, even if he's safe at first, the throwaway is much better than if he's safe on a fielder's choice, because he's a second base and he can score on a single. So everything went perfect. And the Giants basically pulled I hate to say it, but they pulled a Cubs.
They did.
I seem to recall up by 3 runs game situation similar to that. Blowing a tailor-made double play, and you know, and making stupid management. I've lived through it, so I know how it feels.
There's nobody in a sweater and headphones on the side of the stands. They're getting involved in this one. This was all Bruce Bochy being Mr. Ultra Manager guy.
I texted you the next morning. Thanks, Bruce. Sometimes you outcoach yourself, and he outcoached himself.
Yeah, all those comebacks you're talking about, the comebacks from down 3-1s in the ninth, I'd love to know how many of those had that many pitchers going for him. I'm sure all of them were just like one relief pitcher just melting down in the ninth inning and not being able to get out of his own way. It wasn't let's go get everybody in our bullpen and just keep making moves and switching and going back and forth and have all of them give up a base runner, every single one of them. It wasn't anything. You've never seen anything like that in all of baseball. Never.
If I was the official scorer for that game, I would have hung the loss on all the pitchers in the ninth inning.
Give them all losses. Five L's.
They all get L's right next to their name because they all earned that. Actually, can you put the L on Bruce Bochy? He deserved that.
Yeah, that's who deserves the losses, the manager. The pitchers already feel like losers, all of them, but it's the manager that really lost that game. It really was. Then as opposed to what the Dodgers did last night and making it to the NLCS where the rookie manager, Dave Roberts, says, okay, here's my best guy. Here's my best closer, my best relief pitcher. It's the seventh inning, and I'm in a dire situation. You know what? Go get him and stay in there for the eighth and go back out there for the ninth and stay out there as long as you can and rack up however many pitches it takes. And if you run out of juice, then I'll go get my actual best pitcher who might be on one day rest, but damn it, he's the best pitcher I got. And I'm not going to blow this game by going and get some reliever no one's ever heard of, such as Derek Law. So good job out of Dave Roberts.
Hey, it's win or go home. It's the final game. You know what, Clayton Kershaw, he's a horse. He's like, hey, you know what? You feel better with Clayton Kershaw to get two outs than you do with anybody else in that bullpen after you just burned your closer in the seventh. And again, in a crucial point, tough part of the lineup, you know, thinking outside the box, outside the norms a little bit. If this was a game in, you know, mid-August, it would have been your typical bullpen kind of game. Because again, managing in the playoffs is different, and you got to give Roberts credit for making a move that was not your traditional baseball move, doing what it needed to win a closeout game to ensure that his team plays again. Did he burn Kershaw for maybe a little bit deeper into the series against the Cubs? Yeah, maybe we see him in game three. I don't know if they're going to try to race him back for game two. Clayton Kershaw has not been a tremendous postseason starter to begin with. I say rest the guy, but as a Cubs fan, I want to see him in game two, actually. So please start him in game two. I want the guy who hasn't been a very good postseason starter to begin with on short rest. Whereas the Cubs are going to be
in Wrigley Field.
Game two would be in Wrigley. Yeah, that would be against Hendricks. Otherwise, he'd be game three against Arrieta. A very similar situation to what the Cubs faced with Arrieta going up against Bumgarner. And honestly, Arrieta pitched well enough to win it. He wasn't great, but he wasn't
terrible. And hit well enough.
He did pitch well enough to win it. I mean, they were 3-2 when he went out. And then the bullpen sort of, you know, went poof. And then the Cubs still came back and tied the game. So, it'll be an interesting series. I've got that good bad feeling right now. The good feeling I have is that the Giants were really the team that I think the Cubs needed out of the way, and then the bad feeling is that they're the Cubs. It might not matter.
I understand that, but this is a feeling that most of us aren't used to as Chicagoans. Period. That it's a series where you have the best team and winner goes to the ultimate championship round. We don't know what that feels like in baseball. That's never really been the case. Well, if it has, maybe in three, maybe. But if we don't want to talk about that, maybe 84, although the Padres were really close to even with the Cubs. But it's not something you're used to. So it's definitely something different. And if you feel like I did with the White Sox, then you're just going to kind of sit there and hold your knees together and rock back and forth and watch nervously and try not to have too many dark thoughts as the ups and downs of the series goes on.
And the DS was nerve wracking enough. I mean, that was a well-played close series. You know, you had the bad feeling after they blew it in game three, losing the 3-0 lead, but realizing as well that, you know, they really did nothing offensively in that game other than Jake Arrieta hitting a 3-run homer until Chris Bryant hit the game tying home run in the ninth. So I felt good about them making that comeback and not just going out that way and then stretching that game to the 13th inning. But then to be down 5-2, and, you know, here we go, and we're going back to Chicago and anything goes, and to just finish it off. And I really hope that springboard, you know, that thing that you always talk about, like that team, like they sort of, maybe it is like a little bit of a monkey off their back. They did something good, and now they can just focus where, and plus I think being in the LCS last year and getting swept by the Mets helps them, because they've all been through it. They've all had the bitter taste. They know they don't want that again. So we'll see. And we don't have to face freaking David Murphy. As bad as I wanted to shove it up Dusty's rear end, I did not want to see David Murphy come back to Chicago again. Good riddance.
Don't have to worry about that guy for one more year. That's definitely good. Yeah, our baseball after shows are going to be very Cubs-centric for the rest of the playoffs here. So you'd have to understand that with us being former Chicagoans. So you just have to deal with it.
Well, Toronto, your Blue Jays got shut out tonight in game one of the LCS.
Right. They didn't give up much of anything to Cleveland, but Corey Kluber was Corey Kluber, and therefore they could not touch him, and that was the end of that, and Cleveland wins 2-0 in game one. But first game, it's a long series.
Yeah, the best of 7-4. Obviously, we need the best of 5 because the early bits of the playoffs are a little too long with the wild card game and all the possible tiebreak days. Best of 7, best team usually wins. I am with you thinking that Toronto and their hitting will eventually win out, and that the other than Corey Kluber, that Indians rotation doesn't inspire a lot of fear. And I think we'll see in game two with Trevor Bauer, I think we'll see a little bit of a turnaround in that Toronto offense. And Toronto's number two and number three. Marco Estrada's a nice pitcher. But I think as we see their other pitchers in these games, and we see Sanchez and we see Stroman, I think you'll find out that their two and their three are better than what Cleveland offers after Kluber, now that Carrasco's hurt. So as the series goes on, I think Toronto's bats warm up. And I wouldn't be stunned if this is Toronto in five. I would not be shocked if this is the only win for Cleveland. Because if they face Kluber again, it'll be in Toronto, potentially. Or do they do the 2-3-2 now, or is it 2-2-1-1-1?
I think it's still 2-3-2, but I'm not totally sure.
Pretty sure it's 2-3-2 because that's the way it's mostly been, because it's too hard for baseball to do the 1-1-1. It's not like basketball.
Yeah, they're used to going back to to our three-game series and then going to for the two-game. So I don't think it's something that they would want to do is go 2-3-1-1-1 like that. So, yeah. 17th, 18th, and 19th are at Toronto, so that's 2-3-2.
So if the next time we see Corey Kluber is game five in Toronto, I would not be stunned that it was 3-1 Toronto, and that's the closeout game, honestly. I hate to call a shot right here. I'm going on record right now. If I had to call it, this is Cleveland's only win.
And the sad luck Indians once again. Yeah, if they had Carlos Carrasco and Danny Salazar to follow up, that would make a much more compelling series. But yeah, when it's going to be Trevor Bauer and whoever else they got, Clevinger is scheduled to start game four for Cleveland. Who is Clevinger?
Didn't the Mariners cut for his tweeting? Oh, wait, that was the wrong one.
It's different Clevinger. The white trash Clevinger. Yeah, that's a different guy. So, Tomorrow is Happ and Tomlin. So Josh Tomlin for Cleveland, which would be a nice, you know, fourth starter, Josh Tomlin. But as your number two, not so much. And then, as you said, Bauer for game three, and now Clevinger is in line for game four. Mike Clevinger.
I would not be stunned against those three that Toronto's offense and those bats wake up tremendously. Because they score in bunches. That is an assault, that team. And, you know, with good offense, good pitching can usually shut that down. But, yeah, the guys that Cleveland's going to be running out there in the next few games, none of them inspire much fear or confidence. So I really do think Toronto, even losing tonight, if they'd won tonight, forget it. Toronto would have won this game. You could have just been like, you know what, just stop playing, guys. Bye-bye. Cleveland, just go to bed, because this was the one they had to win, but I think it might be the only one they win.
And I'm not even going to ask your Dodgers-Cubs prediction for obvious reasons.
I have to abstain because I don't want to jinx my team saying something the wrong way. Clearly, neither one of these are teams that I had picked to be in this position. I actually had the Giants keeping their even year thing going and going to the World Series, so I'm glad I lost that, by the way.
Yeah. I'm sure you are.
I want to see the Cubs play well, but this feels like that kind of season. Now, not to say they wouldn't be back again next year, but you can never bet on next year. You never know what's going to happen. Who's going to get hurt? Are things going to work out the same way? You got to think they're going to be good for a few years. I mean, all these players are just going to keep getting experience, getting better. That minor league system is just going to keep funneling players through. But, you know, this has felt like a World Series or bust kind of team since last year, since they got to the LCS as that young group. So, very, very hopeful would be the proper word.
Well, I'll be hoping with you. I'm, like I said, I'm a Sox fan through and through, but I'm rooting for the Cubs because they're doing it the right way, and they got a bunch of kids you have to like. You can't help but like them, and I'm rooting for them. Break the curse and finally win one, and then I don't ever have to hear Cubs fans whining about never winning a World Series again.
Oh, no, but then the other side of that will stop. We'll start, which you'll never want to ever hear again, which is the Cubs fans talking about winning the World Series. So,
oh, yeah, it'll be quite unsufferable. I understand that. But they're long-suffering, so I actually hope they get it. All right, you have a long day.
I'm your best friend. Just do it. Just want him to win for me. You got yours. I want mine.
That's right. No one can ever take 2005 away from me. So, win one for you, and you can have 2016, and no one will ever be able to take that away from you. Absolutely. All right, so you have a long day tomorrow. You have a funeral. I have a long day tomorrow, my fifth wedding anniversary. Where I'll be working actually the first half of the day, and then I'll be going to dinner, and then we'll be going to see, they're not calling themselves the New Kings of Comedy, but it's basically the New Kings of Comedy tour is coming in tomorrow. Cedric the Entertainer and some new faces on the comedy scene. I guess George Lopez isn't a new face necessarily, but he's new to the sort of Kings of Comedy tour. So we'll see how that goes. I'm hoping that's going to be a funny show. But either way, it's our fifth anniversary. That's the main part. So we'll be enjoying ourselves no matter what.
Happy anniversary. Tuesday. I remember being there for it 5 years ago.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, you were there. You announced us in. You were the PA announcer to announce us as husband and wife for the very first time. So very glad to have you there for that.
All right. Have a fun one.
Man, 5 years. Whew. Time flies. So Tuesday night for our recap show?
Yeah. Yeah, Tuesday night. I'm working on Tuesday, which I don't normally do. So I would say you might want to put us down for 9:30.
Okay. I will do that.
Tuesday. But I'm good to go Tuesday. Just need to make sure that I'm home. You know, from work.
Right. So it's going to be a fun Sunday. 10 games head-to-head with each other. So we'll see how all that shakes out for week six NFL.
Maybe I can get I need my revenge. I need to get back at you. I need to pick up a few here.
I need to hold you off as long as I can. All right. Tuesday night, setting up for 9:30 Central Time for our recap show for the rest of NFL Week 6, recapping what happens after our big Sunday where we're head-to-head on 10 games. He's Jay. I'm Dre. This is In Much Less Detail, the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back Tuesday night. Go Cedric! Go Cedric! Go Cedric! Go Cedric!